Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, I am honored to be in dialogue with Dr. Melila Helner-Eshed. We will be discussing her new book, Seekers of the Face, Secrets of the Idra Rabba, The Great Assembly of the Zohar, published by Stanford University Press, 2021. Melila, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here and delighted that we can both talk about the Idra and about the book. So here we go.
Thank you. Please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the scholar you would become as an adult?
I was born in Jerusalem to parents that came from the United States in the 40s to Palestine, to then Palestine as Zionists. And I grew up in a very non-Orthodox and yet very spiritual and Jewish home. I never heard about the Zohar in my youth or adolescence. But I feel that the love of things having to do with mystery came from both my parents, and that's something very wonderful. And then when I was 20, I went traveling, and someone gave me a gift, which I didn't even know what it was, and I am not sure till today who gave me the gift. But when I was sitting in Norway, I opened the book. And I read a passage in English. I had no idea what I was reading. I was just so enthralled with what I read. And then I saw that on the book it said Zohar, you know, translations into English. I had no idea translations from what. And I think that was it. That sealed that love for life. And all I felt was, you know, why didn't anybody tell me about this? And I want to know more. And basically all the rest is history. Everything else was finding the great teachers that were at the Hebrew University. My teacher, Yehuda Leibitz, who's been my teacher for 30 and more years, and finding great, great teachers of, you know, comparative religions, of comparative mysticism, but mostly learning how to swim in that, you know, great ocean of the Zohar. And I think that's what brought me to this place of not just enjoying to read and not just enjoying to teach, but also like taking the task of writing about it to the general public. That's what I would say.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to readers?
Well, I wrote a book, the previous one, before this book on the Idra, was a book called A River Flows from Eden on the Language of Mystical Experience in the Zohar. And it was something that enchanted me. Like, can I dare enter that big question of, can I give language to the type of experience, okay, like special kind of emotional, religious, spiritual, mystical experience that we find in the Zohar. Can I find a way to give it language? Can I find a way to put it in some kind of organized way without killing the theme? And it was a very wonderful project, and I loved doing it. It was really kind of delving into the world of the Zohar, the world of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great protagonist of the Zohar, and his group of nine disciples, and kind of entering into that world of mystical imagination and writing about it. And it was a wonderful task of love. And then years later, after teaching for many years at the university and writing and teaching, I thought, okay, it's time to go to the real intense text called the Idra Rabba, which is a special story found in the Zohar, the story of the great assembly of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and the disciples. We'll talk about it in a moment. We have more and more moments to talk about it. And I thought to myself, dare I do this? And when I say dare I, I've said that pretty twice now since I've started. There was something very, you know, kind of ominous. Here's a text that has the status of kind of the Holy of Holies of the Zohar. It has that status both within the Zoharic text and in the way it has been received throughout the generations. And it's a very cryptic and difficult and complicated text to access. And I thought, can I do this? Will it be okay? You know, I'm a woman, I am not Orthodox. I did not come from a classical teaching and learning of mysticism coming after other kinds of classical rabbinic texts. And I'm not the traditional participant of this culture, right? So like, can I actually do this? And it was very interesting that I even felt like I need permission. I need to feel that it's okay. So it took a while to kind of warm up. And then I said, no, I think I'm getting it. And if I am slowly feeling that I understand kind of the pulsating heart of this story and that it is so amazing and in its religious imagery and its theology and its mythical quality, I think I have the tools with which to convey it to other people because it's going to be too hard for them. So I spent 10 years in this story of the Idra Rabba and 3 years of translating the Idra Rabba from Aramaic, which it's written in Zoharic Aramaic, to Hebrew, and then writing about the grand themes of this story. So it really came about, first of all, because of a feeling that there's something ripe in me that I can now tackle this very cryptic kind of text on the one hand, and on the other hand, a strong feeling that this is a time that actually, or our generation is a time that has ears in order to be attentive to the message and to the kind of a mission that the Idra Rabba conveys.
What are the primary themes in your book? What story, quote unquote, does your book tell?
Well, I first of all found it important to describe the great story of the assembly. Okay, this is a dramatic story describing a kind of rite of initiation of the disciples of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai into pillars that the world can rest on, into spiritual pillars. And it's a fascinating story on that level. It's also a story of intense urgency from the point of view of the state. Divinity is in the world of humanity. And it's also a kind of very fascinating theology portrayed in very mythical ways. And I'll tell the story of it in a moment, but I just want to say that when I came to write about it, I thought, okay, the first thing, first of all, to describe what's happening. This is a story about the faces of God. You know, this very audacious kind of language in which the Idra Rabba uses to speak about divinity. So I felt that there was a need on the one hand to kind of describe the book, allow readers to navigate through the complexities of the different stages of this assembly, and then also find a way to kind of back off and say, you know, with bigger strokes, like, what is the Zohar actually trying to convey in this story? So, and in what way can that relate to things that are of interest to readers today, to religious spiritual seekers today, to students of imagination and religious imagination? I think that was the way I chose to organize the book, and also knowing that for most people it's going to be just too complex to go into details, I really divided the book into two parts, so that the first part is really an overview of the big themes, the big ideas, of the big images of the Idra, to allow readers that want to be at that level to kind of feel satiated by what the first part of the book can give them. And the second part is a much more close reading. It's close reading of many segments, many parts of the Idra Rabba, of really going into the language, into the special symbolism, into the drama that's happening, into the theology. So that was the structure. That was the structure of the book. But I think in order to understand that, maybe we just have to talk about, like, what is the Idra? What is the Idra? What is the story of the Idra Rabba? So I think I can go into that, Ari, and just say something about the story. About the story. So the Idra Rabba is a kind of emergency assembly that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great hero of the Zohar, calls. We're going to even have a chance to look at the text in order to hear it. But I first want to tell the story, and then after that, Ari and I are going to look at the text. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai calls from the corners of the world, from the corners of the field. He calls his disciples, saying, we are in a moment of terrible danger. And the danger is that the uppermost Torah, right? There's an aspect of Torah that is about to disappear from the world. And we have to get here together to use all the power that we have in us, in our intelligence, in our consciousness, in our wisdom. We have to get together and do this. And the opening of the Zohar, the prologue, really describes a beautiful kind of gathering that is very ceremonial. It's kind of the opening of a mystical gathering. And the teacher goes through different ritual aspects and prayers and weeping and coming together and holding hands. They move into a field and they sit under the trees, and they kind of enter already into a special kind of zone from the point of view of consciousness. And then we slowly understand that the reason for the gathering is the need to heal the faces of God. Now, you know, if you're in India, that's okay. But to hear that in Jewish mythology is like very, very intense, to say there is a need to rectify or to heal or to work with the faces of God. Maybe we'll have to explain where that comes from. But what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai does is that he invites his disciples, I would say, like an order of knights, okay, like a medieval order of knights, to muster up all their spiritual strength and all their intelligence and all their mystical power, and actually invoke and describe the face of the uppermost aspect of divinity. Now, we have to remember that in the world of Jewish Middle Ages, both in philosophy and in Jewish mysticism and in Kabbalah, God is not portrayed in a simple way, you know, like an old venerable judge sitting on his throne or a king, or but rather Kabbalah describes divinity as this dimension, this very dynamic dimension of different, of various qualities, various divine qualities that humanity comes into contact with. And whoever even knows just a little bit about Kabbalah has heard the term sfirot, that sfirot are the ways or the modes in which divinity is active within the world of humanity. What is very, very fascinating about the Idra is the Idra kind of puts that language on the side, which is amazing because this is all happening within the Zohar, but it puts the language of Sfirot aside and instead of that addresses divinity in the language of faces, the language of faces. And the call of the teacher is saying there is an aspect of divinity that we are losing contact with, and that is the aspect of divinity as source, as oneness, as unconditional love, okay? That is the aspect of God called in the Idra Rabba the great ancient one, Atika Kadisha, the holy ancient one, or the ancient of days, like we have the name in Daniel, or the great faced one, or the one with, you know, with long breath, with an elongated long breath, which means the patient one, if we were to say it in regular English. And the teacher and the disciples take part in this great bringing and invoking of this space of God as ever present, ever loving, ever flowing love. And the reason that it's fascinating is because it's described in the language of a face, right? Now, if we were Neoplatonists, or if we were doing it in some, we would describe it as a fountain head and flow of water, or we wouldn't necessarily go into very personalized kind of language of faces. But in the Idra, even this highest, most aspect of divinity is described as a face. And the students and their teacher describe, you know, the skull, the brain within the skull of this divine aspect, the eyes, the forehead, the nose, the mouth. And that is a very, very powerful part of the beginning of the Idra, just bringing about, just describing and connecting the descriptions of these aspects of that faith and connecting them to verses in the Bible. And what is very amazing is that each aspect of this white face with long white hair and a long white beard, there's no description of a body. Each aspect of this face is a different aspect of love, or it's a different aspect of flow. The light radiating from the eyes, from the forehead, from the hair, from it's an amazing description. And that is the first, that is the first face of God that is invoked and brought about by this text. And then the teacher says, okay, you know, now we have to do the big work. And the big work is invoking the second aspect of, or the second face of divinity. And that is the face of the Erampin, the face of the impatient or the short-breathed one or the young one. And it is a description of a beautiful face of maybe a young warrior, I would say. It's a description taken, a lot of it is also taken from the Lover in the Song of Songs, but it's a description of divinity, not as the source of just flowing love, but it's actually divinity as dualistic or binary or discursive intellect or discursive mind. And this is actually, you know, the God of Israel, the God of law, the God of structure, the God of yes and no, of sides, of left and right, of ethical and spatial and temporal concepts. And the face of this, this divine face called Ze'er Anpin is described as a face which isn't always open and radiant like Atika, but being the face that is in contact with human behavior, it's also a very reactive face. And therefore, when humanity is acting in some kind of evil way, this face becomes contracted. The eyes become bloodshot, the forehead becomes, you know, tense and contracted. And the teacher, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, teaches the students and the disciples and us that the role of healing this contracted face is allowing it to gaze into the face of the Holy Ancient One. And when this younger face looks into Atika, into the face of the Ancient One, there's a flow, just a radiance, a white radiance that just softens and widens and expands the face of the short-tempered one, and allows the love to flow through it. Now, that's a description that's intensely mythical, right? Mythical, but it's actually theology in mythical language, or it's very theological myth. Okay, I would say that, and I would say that is the first part. That is the first part of the Idra, is invoking these two faces and then creating, you know, kind of tilting up the face of Ze'er Anpin so that it can be kind of inside that river of radiance radiating from Atika Kedisha. And when that occurs, and the face of Ze'er Anpin is expanded and softened, then there is great mercy on all of the worlds. Okay? There's a description. That's how, you know, the mercy kind of fills the places of over-intensified judgment. That's the story of the first part. Maybe I'll stop here for a moment. Ari, if you have questions about that, but I'll just say that it is a very, very intense part of the Idra, and that it has in it, I would say, a theological statement that that was so fascinating for me that it made me want to write a book. Okay, and that was that as a student of religions, you know, I had studied a lot about Gnosticism. I had studied a lot about the options that felt that there wasn't a way to contain divinity in kind of one personhood or one entity, and there was a splitting, right? If we're students of Gnosticism, we know that the splitting was that there's a good, wonderful, divine Father, upper God of love, and that this world and the world of humanity is created by a demiurge, by a half god, by an evil god in many ways, that is keeping an angry god, that is keeping human beings from being in contact with their original source and the uppermost aspects of the divine Father. Now, you could say, wait, the Zohar is speaking about three faces of divinity as this ancient one, then the short-tempered dualistic one, and then we'll come to the feminine later on. But it's very telling that you look at it and say, wait, this looks like Gnosticism. They split, right, the aspects, and they're talking here about two faces. But I think the thing that most attracted me to the Idra was that the theological thrust wasn't to say, wait a second, let us just do away with this God of law, of Torah, of structure, of boundaries, and, you know, let's just open up to divinity as oneness. And the Idra doesn't go that way at all. The Idra goes in the direction of understanding that we human beings, you know, kilu operate and live within a consciousness that is binary and dualistic and discursive and variegated and that delineates the differences between things. And that if that is the consciousness of God, right, the God of the world, the idea is not to do away with that aspect of God. But the question is, how can that aspect be kind of be in a state of optimal chesed, optimal love, optimal good wishing or good willing? So the image isn't of splitting in order to do away with one of the aspects of divinity, but rather to heal the face, to heal the face, which is, you know, another way of speaking about religion, to heal the face of God, meaning heal the Jewish religion, by allowing it to be kind of flooded or washed in the light of divinity's source. I find that to be an amazing, amazing theological statement that really finds a way to contain together or to integrate together dualistic consciousness and consciousness of oneness. And it was worth spending years sitting there in order to discern and understand the intricacies of that language.
Can you tell us your personal story? What does it mean to you to specialize in the study of the Zohar as a woman? What does it mean to you to study Jewish mysticism as a non-Orthodox Israeli?
Well, I think there were years where it was just difficult, right? Because when I wanted to start studying Kabbalah and Zohar, there was no place for a non-Orthodox woman to do this at all, except for the university. The university was the only place. It did not question and was not interested who I am, what I am, where I come from. The question is, am I willing to do the work? And I think I have gratitude to the end of my life to the fact that there is that option. And for a long time, I thought, you know, I'm never going to, how am I going to accumulate all the stuff that the boys got, you know, when they were doing their yeshiva studies, when they were doing their early religious studies. And I didn't come from that background. And yet I found after a few years that actually the fact that I am the outsider in a certain way gives me huge freedom in the way I see and can talk about these very complicated, mythically dense texts. I have more freedom to talk about their, you know, their intense symbolism, the sexuality within them. I felt it's easier for me. It's easier for me to check the kind of gently open up these complicated texts and speak about them than it is for many of my colleagues. So that's been the path, I would say. That's been the path. And I think I also lucked out from the point of view that I didn't have teachers that were kind of very suspicious or very castrating or very kind of controlling, but rather the opposite. You know, great teachers, Yehuda Libous and Moshe Edel, and all these amazing teachers that were actually just saying the exact opposite, like, you know, spread your wings, like fly off, little bird, tell us what you see. And that's something that is very special. And I was also thinking, like, when the first book came out, I said, who in Israel will be reading this book, right? Is it going to, how are people that are Orthodox, are they going to be willing at all to listen to what a non-Orthodox woman has to say about the Zohar? Like, but, you know, we live in open societies where people choose what they do and what they listen to and from who they're willing to receive teachings. And I found that it's opened gates in many, many places. So I'm kind of delighted about that. And I think the same happened with this book on the Iddur Rabba when it came out, that it very quickly became kind of the accompaniment for people, the accompanying volume that you hold when you try and read the Iddur, which is just so complicated to understand, you know, on its own. So I'm very happy that to be an Israeli and to be a woman and to be a Jew at a time that I can actually do that kind of stepping into these texts and really finding the right tone and the right voice that will be very, very, very respectful of these deeply hallowed texts on the one hand, and on the other hand, to allow myself to open up places that are concealed and convey what I find there, you know, be it wonderfully positive or negative, but to do it in a way that holds kind of an integrated respect to this, to these texts, and not kind of not go to the heretical or to kind of tearing the veil off these myths, but actually gently going in and slowly trying to understand and converse with these texts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
What are the aesthetic and spiritual differences regarding the presentation of God in the Zohar as a differentiated being vis-a-vis presentations of God's oneness in other theological, philosophical, and religious traditions?
Well, Ari, I think the nice part of the question is also the aesthetic, the aesthetics of it. You know, in all kinds of religious systems, we could just speak about the one and the many. Okay, the one and the many is a perennial question in philosophy and in the history of mysticism, right? Everybody's trying to figure out language for that and try to understand also how does it occur that we have the many from the one, and what is the relationship of the many to the one? Is it illusion, delusion? Is it dream? Is it real? Is it partially real? Is it an offshoot? Is it expansion of the one? What is it? And we have different languages and different religions. What is so fascinating is the choice of the ego to say, wait a second, let's talk about faces. And when you think of it, you know, you look at biblical language, the idea of the face of God is so important. It's way more important than we think. You know, that is the great benediction of the priestly blessings is about, you know, may God shine God's face on you. May we merit to see that face, right? In the Bible, we say, if God's face is not with us, where can we go? We need, you know, we speak about being able to be in the presence of the face of God, or the desire to see the wrath disappear from that face, and love to be pouring forth from God's radiant face. And I think face is something very, very complex. You know, face isn't abstracted ideas, isn't an abstraction. You know, medieval mysticism and medieval philosophy are like wild about abstractions. They're abstracting everything. And it seems that the people that wrote the Idra and that wrote the Zohar were really, really stepping in and saying, we do not go for abstractions. Abstraction is not the way to go in religion. I think partially what they're saying is, first of all, make no mistake, religion is not philosophy. Religion is relationship. It's events. It's somatic. It's experiences. It's emotions. But it's all the time about relationship. And therefore, their choice is to say, God, in a certain way, has lost God's face. In the great move of Aristotelian philosophy, God has become so transcendent, you know, so pure, so beyond, that actually God has lost God's face. And how can we be in relationship with a God like that? And how can a God like that face our human reality if God has no face? So it's kind of a brilliant moment where they say, no, we really need to, as my teacher Yehuda Libe says, we have to give God back God's face. And that's what they're doing, these seekers of the faith. So they're doing something that when one thinks of, if we're talking about aesthetic and religious kind of norms of Judaism, to be so anthropomorphic and describe the nostrils or describe the path between the nose and the lips of God's face, it's like wild on the one hand. It's wild. It's psychedelic. It's wild. They describe it like from very zoom in, close up descriptions. But what they're doing is they're really saying, no, we are theomorphic. And the affinity between the kind of form of the divine and the human form, we share something Adamic, right? They call it Adam, but it's Adam. And the Adam part of it comes with the idea of face. We'll see later that it also comes with the idea of body. But describing God as face is saying we don't want to describe God now in abstract qualities like love, wisdom, intelligence, grace, judgment. We want to now take you back. We want consciousness to be opened up to speak about divinity in the language of cheeks, in the language of forehead. But it's looking at forehead or cheeks not just as physical aspects of a physical face, but as this kind of kind of filtering light of different qualities of divinity that, because they're structured as face, they allow our face to meet in a certain way that face. That's a very audacious and artistic and imaginative, like wild imagination. And they describe, that upper face of Atika Kadisha is described as a totally white, white face, this white, radiant, milky light kind of flowing out of it. Whereas when they describe God as the dualistic God, God as dualistic kind of consciousness and thought, he's described as a young face with beautiful black curly hair, like the beloved, like the lover in the Song of Songs. And he is connected to the oneness. He is connected through through the hair of the Ancient One, the white hair that touches the locks, right? The locks, a very mythical kind of image that brings to life this face of the dualistic younger face of God, or more ego-centric kind of face of God, who is also called the one who is outside. It's outside of the oneness. And it's described as a face filled with colors, right? Whereas Atika is all white, this face has beautiful eyes that are green, and there's colors of red and white in the cheeks and in the blackness of the eyebrows. So it's described as this kind of beautiful, beautiful, regal face. But it carries, that face carries in it the fluctuation of wrath and patience and impatience and love. Right? It's like weather, kind of the weather changes in what this face conveys. And that is the experience of humanity according to the state of the face of that aspect. I think maybe it's the time in what we're talking about to say something about third faith. And The third face is described in the Idra is the face of God is feminine. It's the feminine aspect of God. So if the first face is totally white with white hair and the second one has black curls, the face of the feminine of God as feminine, Nukva, is described as multicolored, many, many colors in the curls of her hair, okay, covering her face. And she appeared in a very in the very dramatic second part of the Idra, where instead of only speaking about a different theological or mystical connection, which is the connection and relationship of the gaze of looking into the face of Atika, the second part of the Idra describes the emerging of a body, like an androgynous body, right? That has on one side the masculine body and on the backside the feminine body, with a very intricate description of their genitals and the way they develop in this one body that is connected in its back, okay? So like the masculine and the feminine aspects of divinity here are assumed to first be totally connected in one body. And then once they have fully developed, these two aspects are kind of separate from each other, okay? They separate from each other, where the masculine is all white and takes all the attributes of grace and of love and of mercy. And the feminine standing alone now is all red, and she's carrying all the fiery attributes of judgment, of power. Both of them are very, very unbalanced in this separate state. And what the Idra describes following rabbinic mythology is that this androgyne, this divine androgyne, once it is separated, is now ready to turn around. And instead of being connected back to back, they can now turn and face each other face to face and come together into the full embrace of sexual intercourse, which is the, I would say, you know, this kind of image of the hieros gamos, of the divine coupling, is the goal of this whole complicated system of emanation in a certain way, is to say that there's another way of healing. Healing isn't only kind of looking into the face of Atika, but healing is also brought about by bringing the masculine and feminine aspects of divinity to be in a state of harmony, or in a state of communication, or in a state of attraction of the difference to the different to each other, to make up the one Adam. Adam in the sense of the masculine and feminine in this embrace of love. And that actually that is what allows both the masculine aspect of God and the feminine to be in their optimal optimal presence, that allows divinity of oneness to flow into the world of duality. Okay, that's like, wow, it's an amazing idea. Huh? Into the two that have become one in that state of coming together, that is the vessel, that's the preparing of the vessel that will allow divinity as oneness to flow into our reality. So even though they're describing it as happening on high, that we're talking about the masculine body of God and the feminine body of God and the bringing it together, they are, of course, speaking also about humanity, right? They're saying it is bringing together of the aspects of the masculine and feminine, that when they are facing each other face to face, that allows the flowing in of the consciousness of oneness into our world as well. So I just want to say, I know these things sound very complicated, like what is she talking about? But this is the language of the Idra. The Idra chooses to say, no, we're going to talk about God in the language of body. We're encountering it through the somatic, through the embodied, through the sexualized. We do not see that as something that keeps us away from spiritual or religious understanding, but actually vice versa. And that's something very, very fascinating. So the whole aesthetics of this work is something very rare. It's also rare within the Zohar. It's only two stories that use this language, but saying, let's talk about God in the language of face and then in the language of body is a very, very powerful innovation in a way. So what I have to say about that?
Can you tell us about the personality of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? What is his personal story?
Yeah, maybe I'll say some things to, it's also going to allow us to close kind of, to close this, but, you know, the Idra could have been written down like some kind of theological tractate, right? If we would have depersonalized and taken off all this without. But because the choice is the opposite choice, it is very beautiful that it's set within a story. And the story is the story of this great teacher, the great master Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is portrayed in this work. He's the choreographer, he's the teacher, he's the one who points out the different levels of consciousness attained in every moment of this great ceremony of the Idra. He's the one who notices moments of danger. He's the one who notices when, you know, the words of students are like they're going beyond the pale of he decides he directs very, very profoundly the whole event. And he himself is portrayed as somebody who is both human and yet carries kind of, how would I call it? He's like transpersonal qualities, connecting the world of divinity and the world of humanity in this story and for his disciples. And he's portrayed in a wonderful way, both as the person convening all the students, or as the teacher weeping before the beginning of this ceremony, saying, "Woe to me if I reveal, and woe if I don't reveal," like allowing the students to see the teacher in those moments, and also his role in kind of regarding the fact that three of the disciples die an ecstatic death, mystical death, before the end of the ceremony. And the way Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as the great teacher like tries to understand what this means, you know, what is the meaning of this? What way can the fact that they've left the physical world be part of this integrated experience? What does it mean about him as the leader of the group? He He's a fascinating director, producer, shaman, master of this whole event, and you know, it's just that the next part of the Idra language in the Zohar, the next story, is the small assembly, the Idra Zuta, right? Rabba means the great one, and the Zuta means the small one. And the Idra Zuta is really the great story that tells of the day of his passing from this world, the day of his death. I think I wanna you know, for I wouldn't like our conversation to end before saying something about what does this language mean to us? Like, what could it mean to people living in the 21st century? And I think what I found inspiring, very inspiring, is actually to get to know this gem of, you know, classical Jewish mysticism on the one hand, just to know it, to even know that it exists, but what is living in it as a message is the idea of saying, this is a call for the healing of Judaism in a certain way from the point of view of the authors, and saying, we want to be part of this story. We want to be part of this religion, but the God of Israel, the way we have come to understand and speak about God is lacking. It's too contracted. As a religion, Judaism has placed so much energy on the discursive and on the binary and what's allowed and what's not allowed and what's ethical and what's not ethical and what's all the laws of, you know, this side and that side, that there has been a lack, or there's been a loss that must be kind of tended to. On the one hand, allowing Jewish language or Jewish religious language to be deeply connected to divinity of source, which is portrayed in the Idra as the face of Ari Chanpin, the great face, or the very patient one. And on the other hand, to allow Jewish religious language to be connected to the feminine, to be connected to the language of the feminine, to the language of immanence, right? Not of transcendence, to the language of divinity within time. Divinity is indwelling within the human experience, within the body, within birth and death, that both the feminine and the and God is oneness are aspects that need to be nourishing the central image of Yudhi Vavhe or Zeranpin, or the God that is at the center of normative Jewish religious language. So I see that invitation to speak about that, not just in language of wrath and critique, but in coming together as a human endeavor to heal this, is something that I feel really can resonate in the minds and imagination of people today, Those are the things that I find fascinating.
In the time we have remaining, could I ask you to interpret a text passage for us or with us?
Let us try.
I'd be curious to ask you about the quotation that you have on page 104. You quote from the Zohar 3:132b. Rabbi Shimon said, "All lamps, you companions, who are in this holy ring, I call the highest heaven and the highest holy earth as witnesses that I see now what no human has seen since the day that Moses ascended Mount Sinai the second time. I see my face shining like the light of the powerful sun that is destined to radiate healing for the world, as it is written from Malachi 3:20. For you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will shine with healing in its wings. What can you interpret this? Can you put this in context for us?
Yeah, I would love to. This happens not in the beginning of Vidra, but it happens like after they describe the first aspect the first phase, the face of Atika Kadisha and its long beard and the flow that is the overflow of love flowing from it. But when Rabbi Shimon makes this statement, it is a statement that on the one hand is ars poetic from the point of view of the whole Zoharic endeavor, but from the point of view of the teacher, he's saying to them something very powerful, positioning Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai vis-a-vis Moshe, Moses, vis-a-vis Moses. And what he says here, he says, Moses was in the experience of being in contact with the divine, but he was not reflective or of it. Okay, he was in the experience. When he came down from the mountain, his face was radiant, right? Like a sun also. But he did not know, right? The biblical text says it explicitly. Moshe did not know that his face was radiant. And I think the importance of this passage in the Zohar is that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying, I am different than the biblical hero. Whereas Moshe is the bestower of the written Torah, right? Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. And I would say Rabbi Akiva is the prince of oral Torah. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai here is the bestower. He's the one who transmits the Torah, the teachings of mysteries, right? Of secrets, of the thought, of the world of secrets. And I think he's saying here, what is different between me and Moshe is that I am both in the intensity of this experience, and I'm also aware of it. I'm also reflective of the fact that my faith is radiant. And the fact that I am aware of it does not take away from the experience. You know, we generally think that you're either in the experience or you're reflecting on the experience. But he's saying, no, I am seeing my face shine. And it's also kind of an intense statement. You know, you'd expect it from some Khalaj or some Sufi master to say, I am now experiencing myself as a radiant sun that doesn't bring burning or wrath. It brings healing. But I think it's saying, I see myself either reflected in your faces, my disciples, or being reflected in the world around me. But I can see that I am now in a state of maybe the motto of the Zohar from the book of Daniel that says, and the enlightened ones shall shine like the radiance of the sky. And I think this is one of those moments where he's saying, I am experiencing the radiance, and as a teacher, I will not stop saying something about it to my students, and know that this radiance is something that is actually preparing the way for a change of consciousness that will come about in the end of days. Or so I think that's, it's a very, very powerful statement there in the middle of the Idra. So it also, I'm happy that we could kind of open up a little sliver of a Idraic text, because it also gives us a sense of the language, the drama, the pathos, the grandness of it. So thank you for kind of opening up the text as well. Okay.
As we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you tell us about your current research? What are you working on now? Is there any connection between your current work and this very book?
I'll say that after spending years inside of the intensely complex world of the IDRA, my choice was to go very much in a different direction after this. And during the shutdowns of COVID, me and a very dear colleague of mine, Omri Shasha, sat and together on Google Docs composed a beautiful new introduction to the Zohar, which is very needed both in the Israeli world, but we've also finished translating it into English, and it's going to be coming out in Brandeis University Press this kind of 23, I hope. And it was a beautiful choice of saying, you know, after being in that world of the Idra, now just do that gift of love of writing a book that is scholarly and not academic, of all the things that we've learned to love and love teaching in the Zohar that will be open to the general public, both for the Hebrew readers and for the English language readers. And that book is coming out in Israel in a month, and I hope that it will be coming in English in the next year. And that's been a great, great pleasure to be working on it. We're still working on that. So it's kind of the other side. It's the other side of the Idra saying, no, now let's go into the wide kind of wide angled look at the whole, at this whole incredible work of Jewish mystical imagination. So that's what we're working on. And I think the book is going to be called On the Path of the Tree of Life. So I'm very delighted that that's the new thing coming up.
Amazing. It will be a masterpiece. It will be really, really, really something when it's out and available. As we bring our dialogue today to a close, I'm your host on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, Ari Barbalat. Today, I have been in dialogue with Melila Helner Eshed to discuss her new book, Seekers of the Face, Secrets of the Idra Rabbah, The Great Assembly of the Zohar, published by Stanford University Press 2021. Melila is a senior research fellow of the Kogod Research Center at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. Thank you.